You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. I am joined by Jordan Bastian, and it's our first podcast of 2017, JB. How you feeling? What do you got on tap for the new year? What's your resolution for 2017?
Oh, my resolution is to, let's say drink less coffee, but I guess that's probably not going to happen, you know, especially after going through that postseason last year. I think I set an all-time record. So going to try and taper back a little bit, which will be like still way more than the average human.
I don't drink coffee, but that postseason had me very close. It was about as close as I've come, I think. So if they get back in 2017 and make a similarly deep run, you might have to join the Starbucks crew with you. But for now, the Indians are making certainly a big move to get back to the postseason. That, of course, is the Edwin Encarnacion signing. We have not done a podcast since this news broke shortly before Christmas. And that's a big one, JB. You knew it was potential for him to, quote, fall into their hands, for his price tag to drop. I wouldn't say it dropped precipitously. I mean, they're still expending $65 million guaranteed over the next 3-4 years. You know, the extra $5 million, of course, being the buyout of that fourth-year option. So a tremendous investment for this club and just kind of speaks to where they're at in the competitive timetable.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to your point, I still think this is higher than the price range that I thought the Indians would be players. You know, so
right.
I think it's a credit to Cleveland that they did go outside their comfort zone. You know, I didn't think they were going to have a comfort zone really at all in this type of free agent signing, and now it's the largest contract in terms of guaranteed money that this team has ever given out. But if there was a time to do it, as I think, you know, everyone has talked about, whether it's us talking about it or fans talking about it, you know, the time is now. You know, they already made that bold statement by going and getting Andrew Miller and giving up a lot of prospects. And now, you know, they want to win one more game than they did last year. And that would make them the World Series champs. And going out and getting, you know, arguably the best right-handed power hitter in the game is a good way to make this lineup even better. A lineup that was fourth in the league in runs scored, you know, without Michael Brantley for much of the year, you know, now you are getting Encarnacion and potentially getting Michael Brantley back, you know, to what level we'll see. But I think this is a clear upgrade for the lineup. You know, Mike Napoli brought a lot to the team behind the scenes, on the field. You know, it was a great, memorable one-year run for Napoli and Cleveland, a season that Indians fans will remember for years to come, not just for his homers, but for the whole party at Napoli's mantra that kind of swept over the fan base. You know, that was a lot of fun and raised a lot of money for charity. So he did a lot of good in his year there. But when you got a chance to bring in a premier slugger, you know, like Encarnacion, and kind of continue to put your foot on the pedal with the World Series as your goal, you know, I think you got to do it. And the Indians made a pretty big statement by doing that.
Yeah, Napoli's track record doesn't have the consistency of Encarnacion's. Now there's, you know, of course, Encarnacion is entering his mid-30s, so there is the potential for a lag there. But this is a guy who's really had tremendous plate discipline to go with the power. And that's, of course, something you didn't get with Napoli. So, you know, he's not going to strike you out of innings, generally speaking. So that bodes well. And I think just, you know, for a team with really – the division is totally there for the taking. We've spoken before about just kind of the changing dynamics within the division and transition going on in Kansas City and Detroit in particular, and Minnesota for that matter. So it's just a great opportunity to kind of capitalize on what is a win-now roster. So really cool that ownership stepped up, and it sounds like the fans are stepping up as well. There was a surge of season ticket sales just after the news broke. And that was kind of the lingering question, maybe still is the lingering question going into 2017. Will they have the support that this fastly, you know, increasing payroll demands? They're jumping up and well north of $100 million at this point. I think they're in the 130-something range as it projects for 2017. We're just clearly not accustomed to seeing that from this franchise.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about it going north of 100, we were talking about the largest payroll in the history of the franchise, and granted, it's all relative. That's not saying,
sure.
You know, I mean, there was a point in time where they had the highest payroll in baseball, you know, but times have changed.
But even comparing it to where they were a year ago, I mean, it's just a significant jump.
Yeah, so it's great. A lot of positives. Great to see ownership step forward the way they have, both in terms of allowing the trade in terms of prospects. You know, that was a lot to give up for Andrew Miller and to take on his salary for multiple years. And, you know, they've always said when the window's there, when the time is right, when it makes sense, that they would step up and do this. And fans have been kind of waiting and waiting to see that. And this is another opportunistic moment for this franchise, given the landscape of the division. And, yeah, it's been positive to see the reaction of the fans. You hope that trend continues because the reality still remains that, fans coming to games and being in the seats and attendance figures and revenue in that way still is maybe more impactful for the Indians' progress and sustainability than it would be for a lot of other teams. So, you know, hopefully they can maximize this run, you know, keep that grip on the Central, make the playoffs, have some more deep runs in them, and continue to generate that revenue that can help this team do some of these things because, you know, they just weren't able to do them in the past. And, you know, they had to hope that signings like Mike Napoli, you know, would turn out the way they did. And because of that one and other ones and, you know, some core development, you know, guys being drafted and developed, guys being acquired in trades and being developed, you know, that has all kind of culminated to this moment here. And it's nice to see them, like I said, kind of put their foot on the gas and try and take advantage of this opportunity.
Yeah, these are human beings who play this game. So any signing, especially of this magnitude from a price point, it's going to be iffy. There's going to be, you know, concern there that he doesn't live up to the contract. But this was the least iffy proposition available to them. Yoenis Cespedes wasn't going to be in their price range. We didn't think Encarnacion would be in their price range, and he was. And I'd say that's good anytime you can get the least iffy proposition available to you. But in this case, it's particularly important just coming so close as they did. And can Jose Ramirez repeat what he did last year? Could Mike Napoli have repeated what he did last year? What are they getting in Michael Brantley? We simply don't know. And that's been a talking point as well here recently. Not terribly unlike, I remember the winter meetings, prior to the 2016 season when we heard Peter Gammon's rumblings that he might not be available until August. That turned out to be true and not true. It was about that bad. Maybe he shouldn't have been available to them until August just because of the way things worked out. And now we hear Jonah Carey, respected baseball writer, saying he hears it's a horrific injury and the odds are not good of him being a productive player in 2017. To that I'd say, I mean, horrific is, you know, the arm detaches from the body. So I don't know about horrific, but I do understand the sentiment, though, that we're talking about two surgeries on the lead shoulder within a year of each other. I mean, that's a lot to come back from. It's all guesswork, but what are your thoughts on Brantley's situation at this point?
Well, I mean, it was horrific in terms of baseball. He only played 11 games last year. I think we can already classify this as a bad injury. And even if he returns healthy, quote-unquote healthy, as in he's able to pick up a bat and swing and play in baseball games, we don't know what Michael Brantley we're going to get. I don't think we can set our expectation to third finisher in MVP voting Michael Brantley. The shoulder and the biceps, they called it chronic tendonitis on the biceps. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but chronic is not a word you like to hear associated with that. He was supposed to start hitting in late December. We haven't really gotten much of an update there. We'll find out, you know, hopefully at the Encarnacion press conference when we get Chris Antonetti and Mike Chernoff. You know, we're going to be hitting them with all kinds of questions on Brantley and, you know, there's still interest in re-signing Roger Davis, among other things. You know, so we'll hopefully get a little more clarity along those lines because, you don't like to hear reports like that, but as you mentioned, we went through similar things there. Again, the thing I keep going back to is the positive of this situation going into this year is they did the surgery earlier. The prior season, they waited. They tried to go through this comeback period after the season ended, and they pushed it to a point where by the time he had surgery, it wiped out most of spring training and made it unrealistic for him to make the team. The positive here is he had it in August, so if he is able to hit and get ready, he should conceivably be able to take part in a normal, relatively normal spring training and be ready for opening day. But again, even if he's in the opening day lineup, you know, I don't know. Can you say he's the number three hitter? Do you need to protect him a little bit? Do you need to give it a sort of a wait and see period to find out what type of hitter he's going to be? I think the one thing there with his style of hitting that's maybe beneficial is, you know, he's a high contact guy. So, you know, this is a guy that if he can put bat to ball, he could generally be productive. It's just, we'll see if the power will be there again, or, you know, we'll see. So there's so much wait and see, you know, in the off season, it's hard to really get a hold on that. You know, it's a lot different when we're there in spring training and we got eyes on him every single day. Right now we're just going off reports or what people can say, and there's a lot of trust in what the team's saying. And right now the team is saying he's their left fielder and he's going to be there for opening day.
All right. Well, we as Jordan alluded to, we will hear more about Encarnacion later this week. He will be in Cleveland on Tuesday and on Wednesday for his physical. I got my day screwed up with a holiday here. Wednesday for his physical, and assuming that goes through, a Thursday press conference, and he will get grilled by Jordan Bastian with the hard-hitting journalistic questions, I'm sure, right? What do you got for EE?
Right,
big,
yeah,
big hard, picture questions
hard-hitting
for
questions for sure, yeah. Yeah, I got that.
It'll be interesting because this is obviously a major deal for the Indians and a lot of emphasis now on 2017. So it's going to be a fun year, and we will be all over it here on these podcasts. JB will be all over it for Indians.com. We'll continue to check in with him each week. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. It's been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox, our first look at the White Sox in 2017. And I am joined by Scott Merkin. And, Merk, first of all, I think everybody's making New Year's resolutions this time of year. Do you have a New Year's resolution for 2017?
My resolution is that Michigan will win a national title this year. I'm not sure if that's really my resolution. I think if it's mine, I would say complain less and appreciate more in 2017. How about that one?
That one sounds reasonable. The Michigan thing is actually impossible, Merk, because they're not going to win it in 2017. If anything, they'd win it in 2018. So
lay the groundwork for the national championship.
Okay, lay the ground. There we go.
Big Ten had quite a bowl season this year, didn't they?
That's true. All right, the Chicago White Sox are obviously in full rebuild mode. They have traded Chris Sale. They have traded Adam Eaton. We don't know what's coming next, but we know something else is probably going to happen between now and opening day. What would you say the White Sox resolution is, Merk?
I think the White Sox resolution is to continue the rebuild, continue building this team to contend for multiple championships, as Rick Hahn has said, you know, 20, 30 times at this point, and not to get skittish if, you know, those trades don't happen right away. I mean, I think we said this last time on the conference call that – I'm sorry, not the conference call. We're not on the conference call, are we? On the podcast. That the rebuild is really hour to hour, let alone day to day or week to week. You know, there are some times where, you know, okay, that's going to take a little while to come through. But, you know, when you have high demands for Jose Quintana, as an example, it could be a team that says no, no, no. And then all of a sudden they say yes, and there goes the deal. You know, the deal happens.
Yeah.
So it's really about just meeting that demand at this point. And the Sox have no reason pretty much on any of the guys they're trading to kind of drop down from what they're asking for. Again, you know, we can't stress this enough. This is not a salary dump rebuild. This is not a, you know, empty the cupboard rebuild. It's a calculated rebuild where they're trying to get as many good prospects back as possible. And you know this, Anthony, from covering baseball for a while. I mean, you know, if you get 15 prospects, 16 prospects overall, how many of those actually pan out to what you want? Maybe a third, something like that. I'm talking about really, you know, make a difference. So that's a key thing. You know, if they want four prospects for Jose Quintana and two of them, you know, top five type guys on an organization, then that's what you stand for. And that's what you don't move until you get that deal. And if you don't get that deal, Jose Quintana is your opening day pitcher, a great kid, would do well with younger players too. Not that he's so old himself. He's a little older than Chris Sale, but still, you know, under 30, and you keep looking and see what happens as you go forward.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, I think there's a real argument to be made for building a rotation around Jose Quintana, just given how affordable he is. And you just look at the division. There's a lot of transition going on with the Twins and certainly with the Tigers and Royals as they try to pare down their payrolls. They're going to have a lot of trouble coming up in the next couple of years to contend. The Twins are kind of a mystery as far as which direction they go at this moment. The Indians are going to run into some payroll issues. You know, obviously they're gung-ho for 2017, but they're going to run into some financial issues beyond that. So I don't know. There might be a window for the White Sox to contend as soon as 2018. It's not terribly unrealistic, given that they just acquired the prospects they acquired, quote unquote, are at or near major league readiness. So, it'll be fascinating.
Here's an interesting point that's been thrown about me during the kind of holiday break here. And, you know, are they, now granted, they're not, you know, what, upper echelon team right now when you trade the best pitcher in the American League and an outstanding, you know, leadoff guy and defensive outfielder like Adam Eaton. But if this makes any sense, are they too good as they stand here right now for a rebuild? You know, because let's just look across town and see how much those high draft picks help the Cubs in the rebuild. You know, Chris Bryant.
Yes.
Kyle Schwarber. So let's say the Sox, hypothetically, of course, finished 76-86. Is that too good for the rebuild process? in the same sense as they shouldn't rush to trade someone because, okay, this is the best deal we're going to get. Let's trade Quintana, or let's trade Frazier, or let's trade Jose Abreu. Winning 76-77 games doesn't seem to really help the process, does it, if that makes any sense at all.
No, you're right. And there are certain draft classes more than others that are worth tanking for.
Right.
You know,
exactly, yeah.
There's a Bryce Harper out there, but that's very few and far between. But, there was this conversation in the game a year ago for some strange reason, just because there was a proliferation of rebuilding clubs, and is there too much tanking going on? Well, tanking, quote unquote, however you want to define it, has been going on in baseball, all sports, for decades. It's if you want to put yourself in the best position for the draft, you do that. If you're going to rebuild, it does make sense to totally gut things sometimes. But again, when you have controllable talent like a Quintana, it does complicate the conversation, because you're right, Merck. It's not a must-sell situation. It's not a we have to move this money. It's just we have to get as good as we possibly can for a couple years down the road. And that might involve having Quintana on the roster. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between outright tanking and then calculated moves to enhance the rebuild. You know, and that's why you can't rush. You can't just say, well, you know, if the best offer on the table for Quintana, again, as an example, is two players and a couple minor league, you know, fillers, let's take it. No, you wait until you get what you want, whether that's in March, whether that's the trade deadline, whether that's next offseason, or whether that never comes about. You know, you wait until you get what you need.
Absolutely. And they have all the leverage right now because there's just nothing out there in free agency.
100%.
And even the trade market. Absolutely. All right. So what else is up with the White Sox, Merck? You got a few key questions going into 2017 on your latest post on the White Sox, on WhiteSox.com. One of those is who will catch? We don't know who's going to be behind the dish in 2017. What are your thoughts on that spot?
Yeah, I'm finishing up an inbox right now, and it seems like every week during this offseason, one of the questions I get is who will catch. And right now their catchers are Omar Narvaez and Kevin Smith. And, of course, Kevin Smith had one of the more unique years I think you've seen in a long time. You know, he was a guy who was, in 2016, he was a guy who was kind of their catcher of the future for a while and then maybe dipped a little bit. Still a hardworking kid. Gets called up in April when the Sox are rolling. Is stretching before his first major league start in Toronto, completely throws his back out, then, you know, is gone for a while, in his rehab process hurts his knee, and finally in September gets a call-up and he got his first major league hit during that time, so kind of a nice story that he came back. But right now I'd say Omar Narvaez, as we sit here, is the starting catcher. Nothing against Omar, who had a really kind of almost a revelation when he came up last year for the organization. I think they're going to look for someone who, you know, can maybe split time with him. I don't know if you necessarily need to go to sign a Matt Wieters as a free agent, you know, but I think you need maybe a little bit of a veteran presence to split time. Omar worked very well with Carlos Rodon last year. He worked very well with Jose Quintana. He worked well with everyone, but those two stood out. So if you can get someone who can split a little bit, then you have a good situation there. You know, they haven't said the Sox, you know, they're not going to spend any money at all. I mean, look at the DH spot. There's a lot of power hitters out in the market still, as you well know. And there's going to be some who are probably going to drop, you know, into February where they're going to need a job. Maybe the Sox can go in and sweep in and pick up a guy there. Again, much like Derek Holland, who they signed for $6 million for 1 year, this could be a great boon and a guy you could have and maybe re-sign and bring back to go with the rebuild, or someone you could flip at the trade deadline too. So I think that could factor into the catching situation also.
You mentioned Rick Renteria on the list. Just will he be a difference maker in 2017? Obviously, he inherits a difficult situation. It's a team that's subtracting more than adding. But it's not a situation, you know, he hasn't been in before, and in Chicago, no less. So Yes. What are your thoughts on Rick Renteria as we head into the new year?
You know, I think it was time for a change there, and I think Robin Ventura, you know, knew it. He was the one who kind of said, I'm not going to be back, you know, in 2017. And Rick is a good change. I've heard nothing but great things. I mean, you know, you heard great things about Robin, too, but I've heard nothing but great things about Rick and just his enthusiasm, his intensity. And I think his personality probably falls somewhere in between the last two White Sox managers, which is Robin Ventura and Ozzie Guillen. And I think he's good for the younger players. I think it's good that he had that year as the bench coach to know some of the guys who are coming back. You know, let's face it, they're not going to trade the entire roster away. So there's a lot of guys who are returning that Rick's already had experience with. So I think he's going to be a good fit. The Sox seem to be very excited with the hire and, you know, genuinely excited. This is not just like, oh, yeah, he's the guy for the job. You talk to people just off the record and just excited at kind of how he's taken this job, you know, and got off and running right from the get-go. From really, you know, his first appearance out at Instructional League in the Arizona Fall League back in October through the team, the organizational meetings, through everything else, that they really like what they have in charge right now.
I alluded earlier to the readiness or near readiness of some of the prospects acquired in the sale and Eaton trades. And by that, I'm referring to Yoán Moncada, Lucas Giolito, and Reynaldo Lopez. We've seen all those guys in the big leagues. Now, there's a difference between, you know, arriving in the big leagues and truly being ready for the big leagues, and the White Sox will make that determination. But what's your best guess as far as how quickly we see those guys on the big league roster, those three specifically?
A little tease on the upcoming inbox, and one person asked me if I thought Moncada would be the opening day second baseman, and I do not think he'll be the opening day second baseman. I think the case for Moncada is when he comes up to the majors, which I think could be June, July, something like that, you know, he's going to be there to stay. I mean, barring something unexpected. You know, I think when they brought Aaron Rowand up, he was there to stay, and he struggled and got sent back down, came back up, and then he was there to stay and had a fabulous career where he won two World Series rings and, you know, became kind of iconic in Philadelphia during his time there. But I think that's kind of the goal for these guys, that when you bring them up to the majors, make sure they're ready. You know, some guys may be a little further ahead. You know, a guy like Lopez in the Eaton deal, I've had a couple of scouts tell me that he could be a good guy this year out of the bullpen, even if, you know, they do see his future as a starter. And, you know, Giolito and Kopech, Giolito had some experience in the major league level too. So one thing that's for certain is there is no rush to get these guys in the majors to validate a trade for Chris Sale or Adam Eaton. You know, when they're ready, they'll be there, and not before. And I think guys, position players like Moncada, it really is important that, you know, when they come up, that's their destiny. That's what they're going to be at. I think Fulmer, you know, they kind of knew, as an example, they probably rushed him a little bit last year, but they knew what was going to happen. They kind of had an idea that there might be some struggles. You're taking him up to the majors. You're taking him out of his normal starting routine and making him a reliever. But they liked the fact that he'd be able to work with Don Cooper, you know, the White Sox pitching coach, on a daily basis, and the information gained out of that. And when he went back to Charlotte, he had a good finish after a few more struggles to the season. So he should be ready to go for 2017 with some good knowledge gained. So, again, I think there's no rush. But they certainly, you know, when these guys are ready, the Sox have proven in the past, see Chris Sale, who pitched in the majors 2 months after he was drafted, for God's sake, that, you know, they are not afraid to promote these guys.
All right, there you have it. The latest from the new and improved Scott Merkin, who is going to follow through on his resolution. Not as sure about Michigan following through on his resolution, but I know Merk has it in him. So I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Chicago White Sox edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. I'm joined for the first time in the new year by Jason Beck. Happy New Year to you, Beck. Obviously, this is going to be a fascinating year for the Tigers one way or another because, and you've written about this, is going to be a year of major change. This roster is going to look a lot different at the dawn of 2018 than it looks at the dawn of 2017. And for all we know, it could look quite a bit different by the middle of 2017. Perhaps you can just kind of give us the overall outlook for this club as we venture into a new year here.
Well, as you referenced, there's a lot of different moving parts with this roster right now. You kind of saw the hints of it at the end of this past season when Al Avila, the general manager, was talking about the salaries that are looming for them, and that they would be interested in moving some players and trying to get a little bit younger and a little bit leaner, at least some of the bigger, moving some of the bigger salary players. That didn't happen, obviously, or it hasn't happened so far, and I doubt anything large scale is going to happen. But now that we're into 2017, I think it transitions to, instead of active movements to change over this roster and get younger and leaner, now you're in a scenario where at the end of this coming season, that roster is going to change over pretty naturally. You've got JD Martinez up for free agency. Ian Kinser and Anibal Sanchez have club options for 2018, so they can hit the open market. You've got Justin Upton, who, depending on what he does in 2017, has the opportunity to opt out of his contract and hit the free agent market again if he wants. Now, you wouldn't expect him to do that based off of what he did in 2016, but if he has a bounce-back year, you could easily see him, given what the dollars are for guys on the market right now, you could easily see him opting for free agency and opting to give it another shot. So that's a huge chunk of payroll right there, just with that handful of players. And it's also an opportunity for these guys to, you know, depending on what they do and what their financial situation is, they could get some comp picks, or if they're out of contention by a July trade deadline, they could trade guys, you know, some of these guys, if not a lot of them, at the deadline and try to get some prospects back. They weren't very appealing on the trade market this offseason, but one would expect there could be, as long as they perform, a lot more appeal for guys with short-term obligations like that in the mid-season market.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, so as we sit here today, you look at the Tigers roster, you look at the rest of the division, it's not inconceivable this club could contend. Obviously, a lot has to go right, primarily from a health standpoint, but it's going to be a fascinating club, and that, for all the reasons you just mentioned, it's how they start the season will truly dictate a lot in terms of direction they take midseason. And I don't think they're going to be in a great position to add on midseason, but maybe they're in a better position to hold steady with some of these guys if they feel they have a legit shot at contention. But if this club gets off to a slow start, you know, April, May, June, forget about it. We could see a lot of moving pieces.
Right, and we've seen in past years, not from the Tigers, obviously, but from other clubs, teams sometimes get out in front of that July trade deadline market and make big moves in June. And if this team gets off to a slow start, there's nothing that would rule out that happening. I know the Tigers rebounded from, you know, pretty horrific start this past season to get back into contention by the end of July and then really even get on the fringe of a division race by Labor Day weekend. But this isn't a team that can afford to do that, I think, this coming year, because of so many tough decisions that they have to make. And also, you've got a manager who's in the final year of his contract. I know, Brad Ausmus was in that situation last year, too, but I think now there's going to be some scrutiny on him because, he's in a lot of ways, this is the last ride for this team as it's made up. But also, he works so well with the young players that they have. You would like to see him around to kind of guide through a reloading, a rebuilding process, or whatever you want to call it. But if they get off to a bad start and there's some urgency to try to make what you can of the season, it could be difficult to keep him around for that.
As we said, the Tigers' competitive chances are very much, and you could say this of any team, but I'd say especially of a team that's more of a reliant on aging players and maybe some questions about the overall depth, is they got to stay healthy. And I think one guy who truly has to stay healthy is Jordan Zimmermann. His first season with Detroit could not have started worse, or his first year of his contract with Detroit could not have started worse, and it could not have started better. By that I mean, the month of April was fantastic, could not have started better, but the season at large could not have been worse. He only pitched 9 2/3 innings over the final 3 months of the season because of neck and back issues. How big is Zimmermann's presence for 2017?
Oh, man, it's huge. I mean, think about it. When you look back, how incredible it was that this guy who was really the ace of the staff for the first month and a half of the season ended up being a liability in the rotation by September.
Yeah.
They kept running him out there hoping that something would click and that, you know, he could at least give them some serviceable innings, and he couldn't even do that. At last check, he was getting injections in the neck to try to loosen up some of the neck and back issues that were hampering him for most of last season. The Tigers sound optimistic at this point that he should be at full strength for spring training and that he can work his way back. But when you start discussing neck and back issues and the guy who's now on the other side of 30, it's nothing's a sure thing. And it's, you know, it kind of reminds you of some of the stuff that Anibal Sanchez has gone through. It, you hope that he comes back to the same form, but that it might be a process to get there, and it might not ever happen. And if it ends up that way, then it's going to be an incredible issue for these guys moving forward as they try to pare down payroll, that if you have a guy making 20-plus million a year, who's going to be in and out of the rotation. So, you know, this is vital, not just for 2017, but I think long-term for these guys.
Another issue, and Beck had a great lead into 2017 on Tigers.com. You can check out just kind of keys to the year coming up. And one of them is Lloyd McClendon, back as hitting coach at the big league level. And, you know, this club was really erratic offensively back in 2016, kind of, as you put it, a feast or famine offense. What is it going to take to get this club to be more consistent?
I mean, first of all, it's kind of, you know, it's odd that we're at this point. Who would have thought a couple years ago, you know, when the Tigers were trying to hire a man to replace Jim Leland and ended up bypassing Lloyd McClendon and hiring Brad Ausmus,
right,
that 2 years later, McClendon would be on Ausmus's staff back in the same role he had as the Tigers try to make one more run at this. It's kind of incredible to think about, but I also think it speaks to how highly the Tigers think of McClendon and his hitting acumen, and also how well he worked with a lot of these veteran hitters when he was around as hitting coach for Jim Leland from 2007 through 2013. I think what he can do for the veterans is big, but also that year he spent this past year at Triple-A Toledo as a manager, I think could pay dividends because he's had a chance to work day in and day out with guys like Jacoby Jones, Steven Moya, guys who could end up playing, you know, somewhat significant roles in 2017, depending on injuries, depending on what the Tigers end up doing in center field. So there's an interesting blend there. I think what you get with McClendon is he's going to put in the work, you know that. And that's not necessarily unique, but he also brings a lot of philosophies that Jim Leland brought to the managerial job in that he knows the difference between working hard and working smart, and he also knows he has a very good sense of what clicks for individual hitters. Now, there's going to be some sense mending, I think, that's going to have to go on maybe with a guy like Anthony Gose. If the Tigers don't do anything else in center, Gose might end up going into camp as one of those candidates to get at least a chunk of the playing time in center until and unless they determine that Jacoby Jones is ready. But right now, it's an interesting fit. I think it's interesting having McClendon back, and we'll see what impact he can have on this offense. But yeah, they do have to get him more consistent, especially a guy like Justin Upton.
Last thing, Beck, a minor move this week. Ed Mujica is signed to a minor league deal with an invite to big league camp, and it just seems like these are the kind of moves that we're going to be seeing from the Tigers these next few weeks as they do try to put together, especially a workable bullpen, you know, try to get some low-profile guys who might be due for a bounce back.
Yeah, the only major league contract they've signed a guy to this offseason has been Alex Avila to be the second catcher. It's odd to think of it right now. But, yeah, it's unless some trades come down the line to free up some payroll, I would expect more deals like these as Tigers try to find some guys on the rebound and also try to limit their luxury tax liability. Now, the good news for them is that it's been a slow-moving market, and you can envision a scenario in which you have a lot of guys really all across the board who are looking for jobs at the end of January, beginning of February. That said, you know, when you sign deals like that, they also tend to come with money that you can guarantee a player if he makes the big league roster. So there's a difference between bringing in a guy, taking a shot on him, hoping that he can help you right now versus bringing in a guy for depth that you believe can open the season at Toledo and maybe help you in case of injuries down the line, as they were hoping for with a guy like Bobby Parnell last year, which didn't really work out, a guy like Casey McGee, now, who had some meaningful contributions but never really came around with a bat like they'd hoped. Those are the types of deals I would suspect you're going to see really in a lot of various areas, but center field's going to be worth watching because, as I said before, you know, there's no clear-cut starter right now. And you look at the free agent market, guys like Austin Jackson are still out there. So maybe you take a shot at a guy like that, either on a short-term major league deal or on a minor league deal with a non-roster invite as you try to figure out how to piece together something here is without blowing up the payroll.
Yeah, bring everybody back. You brought McClendon back, bring Austin Jackson back, and it'll be like a happy homecoming there in Detroit.
They're bringing the gang back together. I think if they do that, they should let Jim Leland sit in the dugout for a spring training game or two.
That might work, yeah. Get him geared up for the WBC. So. All right, there you have it, the latest from Jason Beck as we venture into 2017. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. It's been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. This is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals, and I am joined, as I am each week, by Jeffrey Flanagan. Jeffrey, Happy New Year, man. And what kind of year is it going to be for the Royals? It's going to be fascinating because this is a team simultaneously trying to trim payroll and yet remain competitive, of course, in the AL Central. They've already moved about $7 million or so from their 2017 books, but there could be more moves in the offing. They still have six players set to become free agents after 2017. Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, Alcides Escobar, Gerard Dyson, Danny Duffy. They've got a bit of a logjam in the outfield right now. So what's the next shoe to drop here?
Well, I do expect them to probably make at least one more move in terms of a trade before spring training starts. I can't tell you what that's going to be because, as you mentioned, the Royals are trying to accomplish this tough balancing act to, you know, trim some payroll and remain competitive. And as Dayton told me at the end of the winter meetings last month, that they really want to be able to retain some of those six guys you mentioned. They're not just going to let them all walk. So, you know, that's the tricky part of the economics for the Royals, is try to balance all that, keep the payroll in the 140, 145 range, you know, maybe sign a guy like Danny Duffy to a long-term deal, maybe even a Moose, maybe move someone to create some payroll flexibility to do that. And again, keep an eye on the prize, which is to stay competitive in a division, as you know, probably just has two, maybe three contenders in the AL Central. So they fully expect to make another run at the postseason in 2017, so it's not like they're going to gut the team, but there is some maneuvering yet to do.
Yeah, we heard there was a report over the weekend, I believe, Nick Cafardo in the Boston Globe said they could have interest in Pedro Alvarez on the open market. Obviously, the Royals might have some at-bats to give away at DH, but as we just talked about, and the whole point here is to trim payroll, or has been to trim payroll. I'd be skeptical, it seems, about and then again, maybe Pedro Alvarez's price tag just falls so much that it does make sense, or another one of these sluggers that are available in the open market, because there is a game of musical chairs going on that could work in a team like the Royals' favor. But for now, it seems status quo with the lineup.
Yeah, and would he play for $250,000 a year?
you have to ask him.
I mean, it really would put them, they would have to be going in the wrong direction. And the only way anything like that could get accomplished is if, like I mentioned before, if they move some present payroll right now. And I don't really see how they get better by taking a big bat out of the lineup and trading him and then adding Pedro Alvarez, who I'm not a tremendous fan of in terms of his offense, especially at a place like the K. So I don't know. They've talked a lot about the DH being a floating DH. It certainly makes sense from their position. You give guys rest. You know, you've got Chester Cuthbert, who had a pretty decent offensive year last year. He has no position right now with Mike Moustakas back at third base. He's out of options, so he could become the 70% DH a week, and then you give the other at bats to a Hosmer, a Perez, or a Cain to rest them. So I'm not ruling anything out, of course. I'm sure Nick has his sources, or maybe he's just, you know, adding up the pieces and go, hey, this makes sense for them. But they certainly would like that, you know. I think in the long run, it'd be a great fit to have a full-time DH, you know, like they have with Kendrys Morales the last 2 years. But I just can't see the economics of it right now.
You've written that it sounds like, as far as the bullpen is concerned, of course, they moved Wade Davis, and yet still hoping the bullpen can emerge as a strength. It's going to take a lot of creativity there.
Yeah.
As we record this, Greg Holland and Luke Hochave are still out there as free agents. Are those guys, is their era over in Kansas City? Is there still a chance of one of them could come back to the Royals?
I think there's definitely a chance. They didn't show a lot of interest in Greg Holland over the last month or so, but I think they're just kind of waiting to see, you know, what kind of offers he gets. I'd heard some rumors that he at least got a two-year offer from Colorado. I wasn't able to confirm that, but you know, with Hochaver too, I mean, you know, he's coming off that thoracic surgery. You just don't know when he's going to be healthy. I've heard he's on schedule and stuff like that, but that's going to be another wait and see thing. Where will he be ready for spring training for you know, at least March or something like that? Now they could get him with an incentive, you know, based contract, and he certainly has a history here and would like to come back here. I think the Royals would like to get him back here if he's going to be healthy, and they could certainly use him because, like you mentioned, the bullpen right now, you've got Kelvin Herrera, who's a proven entity as a closer. We know he can be dominant. But in front of him, there's a lot of question marks. You know, can Joaquin Soria bounce back? Will Matt Strom, you know, the rookie left-handed sensation from last year, will he be as good as he was last year? You know, can a guy like Brian Flynn step up, who had a pretty solid year last year? And then they've got some guys in the system, you know, a young right-hander named Josh Stamont, who, you know, can hit 100 miles an hour on the gun. And I think he's going to get a chance. But it's going to be piecing it together. But Dayton said, hey, as long as we've got that anchor, which is Kelvin Herrera, we can build a bullpen. And really, nobody does it much better than Dayton over the last few years.
Yeah, it seems a Joaquin Soria bounce back is so elemental to this team's competitive chances, is it not? Just because of what they invested in him, and as you say, the setup situation being so dicey. I mean, there's a guy who's been there, done that, but boy, it's just a steep regression in 2016. What was the final word on that as far as what went wrong for him in his first year back with the
Royals? It wasn't really just one thing. There were a lot of different things going on. I think obviously anytime something goes wrong with the pitcher, they always point to command. It almost becomes a cliche, but stuff actually wasn't too bad. I mean, his velocity was, you know, Ned's mentioned this many times, was better than the first time he went through Kansas City, but that's not everything. Of course, he would just make mistakes, and he doesn't have good enough stuff anymore that he can make those mistakes. So he's going to have to readjust, be better. Early in the year, you know, he got beat on a lot of fluky stuff. Late in the year, there were no flukes to those balls going out of the park 420 feet. So they do desperately need him to be better because they invested a three-year, $25 million deal. He's in the middle of that now, his second year. You're not going to cut bait with that kind of salary when you're a small market team. So they're counting on him. He's got to be better. And Dayton, of course, you know, they're all putting on the good face right now that he's going to be better, and he's going to have to be because there's not that depth that they've had in recent years in that pen.
One last thing, Jeff. I just want to kind of go back to the conversation in the outfield. I mean, it's a crowded trade market in the outfield right now. And the Royals, when you talk about Dyson and Kane, two guys going into last year of their deal, which, you know, maybe it's when you talk about a one-year guy, it's maybe easier to ascertain the value, but it might be harder to get the value, you know, they place upon him, especially with Dyson, just because he is so affordable for the Royals. So is there any scenario, do you think, where they take all of these guys into spring training and try to sort out a lineup that works and keeps everybody in there, you know, enough to stay productive? I'm talking about, you know, Paulo Orlando and Soler. Obviously, there, as we alluded to, there are perhaps some DH at bats to be had. Do you think there's any scenario where all these guys are on the roster going into the season?
I think there is. I mean, you know, they love having depth because, as you know, I mean, you can go into spring training and somebody blows out a knee or something like that, and you go, oh, well,
yeah,
Let's get Dyson Orlando in there. Oh, we traded him. You know, so I don't think they're going to be in a hurry to move one of those guys They're going to start. I think they'll start the year with Kane in center, Soler in right, and you know, obviously Alex Gordon in left, and Dyson and Orlando are the top backups. There's been interest in Dyson, as you know. Obviously, you know, the return hasn't been enough for Dayton to pull the trigger yet. And as you mentioned too, I mean, it's hard to move those guys with in their last years. You just don't get the same value when the team you're trading to doesn't have club control over them for a few years. So it's been tough. I think Dayton's been patient and wisely patient. I wouldn't be shocked if we go into spring training basically with this same roster, and then maybe he makes a move in spring training. But I do think, you know, I still think because they want to sign a guy like Danny Duffy to a long-term deal, they're going to have to create a little bit more flexibility in the payroll. So something might happen, you know, to move a salary. I can't really tell you who it's going to be. It might be one of those outfielders. I kind of doubt it, but we'll see.
All right, there you have it. That's the latest from Jeffrey Flanagan. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. I'm joined here in our first podcast of 2017 by a very special guest, Richard Justice, columnist for MLB.com. Richard, thanks for doing this. Happy New Year to you. And I thought I'd start with getting your perspective on the Brian Dozier situation. We are hearing that the Twins are basically, things are coming to a head. It's the Twins asking for final offers for Dozier. There's no guarantee that they move Dozier. I think whether they do or not will say a lot about how they feel about 2017, and I guess a lot about how they feel about the offers for Dozier. But what are your thoughts on that situation? Obviously, a guy coming off of a career year, 42 home runs, his value might never be higher than it is in this moment, and yet his value to the Twins is still pretty substantial as well.
You know, Anthony, I think when you play the long game, you have to trade him. Because when I look at what they're going to do next year, they're going to probably have at least five players 25 and under in the lineup. And a lot of what is next year is about is, what is Buxton? You got to just put Buxton and Sano out there and find out. You got to take the pressure off of them and let them play. Same thing with Polanco, Kepler. You know, you just got to find out. And with Brian Dozier, if you could get him, I know the Dodgers want him. Do the Dodgers need him? They're a 95-win team without Brian Dozier. But their long game is, we got to catch the Cubs. We want to play in the World Series for the first time since 1988, all that stuff. And he might make a difference somewhere down the line, and he certainly would upgrade them. I would say if I'm the Twins and you got a guy that you're going to have for two more years, he's 29 years old, you could get one pitcher. You could get one great pitching prospect and maybe a lesser prospect, something like that. I think you have to do it, and I know that puts Maurer and Park a little bit more on an island, and it may make them less interesting. But if I'm a Twins fan, I'm going in thinking we got great baseball people running this thing now. We have confidence in them. It's a new way of doing business. It's a new era for the Twins, and we're going to watch a bunch of guys. And it's not just Buxton and Polanco and Sano. I mean, they got guys on the way that are going to be pretty interesting to watch. And we're going to watch players that are going to get better. So we're not sure what we're going to be this year in 2017. It may be, you know, identifying pitching, identifying players that can stay. But I think when you look at long-term, Dozier has to be you have to trade now at a point where, as you said, he's never had a better value.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're talking about a guy who – he puts up really strong numbers, but he's also, there's a lot of streakiness within that. And maybe you take him into the season and hope to flip him at the deadline. Maybe there's a better market for him then, but then you run the risk of that happening maybe in the midst of a slow start. He actually had a slow start to 2016.
Right.
You don't remember it now because of the way, how strong he finished, but he did have a slower start to 2016. So you run that risk of the value not being as high. And yeah, he's probably their most marketable player at the moment, and there's value to that. But, how realistic is it for this club to be a legit contending club in the two more remaining years of Dozier's contract? So, yeah, I think there's a lot of value to making a good move now.
Yeah, and what I'm selling, if I'm the Twins, is like, you know Derek Falvey a lot better than I do. But I was amazed. He's the new president of baseball operations of the Twins. I was amazed at how often that the Indians talked about him, how often Terry Francona talked about him and Brad Mills. I mean, there clearly was not just a relationship, a working relationship. There was a trust in the guy.
Yeah.
And it said a lot about him that he stayed until the World Series was over. And as you know, I know Thad Levine very well, who came from Texas, as bright a guy and as good at organizing a staff and finding, maybe not finding talent, but finding talent evaluators to do it. And I would think we got to understand, look, a lot of what we're going to be this year is, are we right about Sano and Buxton? Weren't they at one time, didn't MLB.com have them rated two of the top three prospects in the game? You got to put them out there and you got to let them play. And if that means trading the guy, then that is the delicate point, though. Like, if you hold the guy and he starts slowly, what does that do for the market? Because it's a brutal game. And I'm sure the reason he hasn't been traded is that the Dodgers are looking at it saying, hey, they feel more pressure to trade him than we do to go out and get him, because we still have Chase Utley as a fallback position. And you have two new guys sort of playing this chess game with a guy like Andrew Friedman, who's played it for a long time. That's not obviously not the only destination for him. You know, the Angels. The Angels had put a lure in the water there before they got to Espinosa. But
right,
it'll be interesting.
And you've heard rumors about the Cardinals, but yeah, I mean the Dozier to the Dodgers thing has been a thing since the very first day of the offseason, and it's one of those moves that just makes too much sense not to happen. Maybe it won't happen. Maybe it makes too much sense to happen. But they've been such a natural fit, and the need for production against left-handed pitching just lines up perfectly. But we know it's hard to swing a deal. But yeah, you referenced Thad Levine pretty well. I know Derek Falvey pretty well. This is just a major transition for this Twins team, just in terms of approach. You know, it's been one of the more old school organizations for so long, and it's no disrespect to Terry Ryan. It's just that the game has evolved so much in a short time, and these are two bright young guys. Take them in the right direction.
Yeah, and Terry tried. You know, when he returned to the job, his whole deal was, we've got to increase our inventory of pitching. And, in the Span trade, in the Revere trade, in the free agency, they went out and tried to get pitching. But it never all worked out. Either a guy got hurt or he turned out not to be as good as he thought. And so Sometimes the hardest thing to do is scout yourself. And I give ownership credit for just saying, okay, we're going to go an entirely new, different direction. We're going to bring young guys in here and see where we're at.
Absolutely. Well, the one move the Twins have made this offseason was the signing of Jason Castro. And as we referenced, you reside there in the great state of Texas. You know Thad Levine pretty well. And Jason Castro very well, being based in Houston. What are the Twins getting in Jason Castro behind the dish?
I think they're getting a team leader. They're getting a guy that gets it in every way, When he was drafted, he was the first draft pick of a new Astros regime, Ed Wade, Bobby Heck, those guys. He was a Stanford guy, and all that implies in being a Stanford guy. And he got drafted while the Cardinal were on a playing a regional, I think it was in Arizona, and I asked a couple of his teammates, I said, well, what did you guys do to celebrate? That's a pretty big deal. You get a guy taken high in the first round. And they said, yeah, Jason, we had the tutor on the road with us, and Jason had a test that night, so he couldn't actually celebrate. I thought that said a lot, that a guy celebrating a contract worth millions by taking a test and spending the night working with a tutor. And that's sort of the seriousness he brought to the job. You know, the Cubs had a big internal debate the last couple of years. Do we want our catchers to be pitch framers or pitch blockers? Their belief being that you can't have both. You can't be both. And they decided a pitch framer can impact, 20 pitches a game, 30? I mean, there's some number in there that's a big number. And a pitch blocker, maybe one or two a game. And Jason Castro is as good as it gets. I was talking to our people at BAM about, he had 96 more strikes called last year than normally would be expected, and that was the fifth best total in the majors. And so what he's going to do when you've got a pitching rotation that wasn't very good last year, you got to do what you can defensively, and you got to do what you can to get pitches. I think it was Terry Francona told us during the World Series that he had gone back and looked at Yadier Molina, a couple of his stealing strikes for his pitchers, and he said, I swear to God, the more I looked at it, I could not see the glove move and I knew the pitch was a ball, and he got a strike call out of it. So there's a real art to that, and Jason is he's a workaholic. He's a guy that will allow his pitchers. I can imagine what it's going to be like him and Irvin Santana working together, allow guys to get into a rhythm and a trust. You know, at their best, a pitcher just wants to have trust that the catcher's right on the location and the pitch sequencing and all that. And Jason is really good at that. His offense hasn't been very good the last couple of years. Ironically, it was Jason coaching J.D. Martinez, and J.D. Martinez studying Jason's swing that led to a career renaissance for J.D. Martinez. But I think they're getting a good one.
Yeah, and it's been a burgeoning topic the last few years in baseball. What is pitch framing worth? Well, now we know. $24.5 million.
Well, that's exactly Castro what he brings. In. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, good stuff from Richard Justice, and we'll continue to check in with Rhett Bollinger throughout the new year. I want to thank Richard for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.